Discussion with the Jiangsu Chen in Cornwall, England, Spring 1978. Recorded by Chip, edited by Jonathan and Sarah. Speakers are Chip, Lyndon, Bron and Sarah.
Direct awareness is more important because it's the moment that anyone can become Sotapanna or Sakatagami, Anagami or Arahata when right understanding grows sharper and sharper.
Chip, I think you're trying to ask what nourishes right understanding. You're trying to, I mean, we know that studying and discussing, these things nourish it. Is there anything else? Because since we can't desire right understanding, it'll just happen. We can't force it, we can't make an effort to have it and say, today I'm going to have right understanding. So what nourishes the right understanding? It is the
reading
and the discussion and the studying.
Considering.
And the considering. And anything else?
That's all.
That's getting a little.
Mm-hmm. And that right understanding accumulates.
Now, what are the four conditions necessary for enlightenment? Okay, the first one is meeting the right person.
Yes.
And the second one is listening to the teachings.
Yes.
The third one is considering the teachings.
Yes.
And the fourth one is
the direct awareness.
Yes, right, the direct awareness. So in other words, there's nothing one can do about the fourth one.
Yes.
One just has to follow through with what one can do about
to be conditioned for the last one.
Okay, the last one arises. Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. That clears up a tremendous confusion.
Yeah, with all the right friends, the listening to the right thing.
Considering.
In order to have right understanding.
But the considering is still at the level of intellectual
understanding.
Mm. And maybe observation of one's.
That's why in the Buddha's time, even the Buddha's disciple followed him in order to listen to his teachings, to have condition for the direct awareness.
It's also must be the right conditions. It's got to be the right conditions for the whole four to meet the right person.
What was the second one? Mm-hmm. To listen, to consider. That's right. And the conditions for the whole form. Mm. And they come in order, do they? Meeting the right person first.
I would say so.
It's not enough to just see or meet the right person.
No.
So the second factor is very important to listen.
Yes, and to consider. And that's four.
I'd like to ask another question, and that is the idea of citta. That seems, I mean, I don't understand it from direct experience, but intellectually I seem to have a grasp of the meaning of this. It seems to be a very, I can understand what is similar between the citta that experiences the visual object, the citta which experiences object of hearing and whatnot. I can see these different cittas, I can see what is similar about them in terms of what they don't do, for example. But the mental factors, the citta-sikas, which they seem to be a great big bundle of all sorts of different things. And I was wondering in what way are they bound together? What is common about them in terms of the way they operate? In some are feelings, some are memories, some are, you know, so many different sort of things. There doesn't seem to be a thread of unity between them.
They are interdependent and they condition one another.
But cittas also have this relationship.
Citta cannot arise if there is no jetasika. The four mental khandhas aggregate arise together simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
They condition one another.
Mm-hmm.
They're all mental factors which all accompany that citta.
Mm-hmm. They're not all karma producing, or they're not all karma.
No,
mm-hmm.
Only cetana cetasika is karma.
Yeah.
For example, passa. Contact. It's mental factor which contact the object. If it does not contact, citta cannot see it, citta cannot hear it. At moment of thinking, it contacts concept that citta thinks about it. Now we have different contacts. One person may see, another person may think. Different cittas by different contacts.
I can understand some of the functions of the few chittasikas that I've studied, but I still don't see why they were all they're all swat kanda, correct? Chittasikas. Or that they're all they're three kandas under there, the second, third, and the fourth. Why? What does chittasika mean? The word chittasika.
Mental factors which arise with citta. They condition citta, and citta condition them by different conditions.
The citta at this moment is kusala. If it's good, then all the mental factors which accompany it will also, you could also and experience the same object, which is why.
In other words, cetasikas are kusala, that it conditions that citta to be kusala. Mm-hmm.
And the citta can be kusala.
When cetasikas are kusala.
But it doesn't condition the cetasika.
It conditions by way of a condition. There are 24 conditions.
Which is why, when I find what I find helpful about it is that, which is why there can't be dosa and awareness at the same time, because when there's dosa, the citta at that moment is akusala. There's nothing good, there's nothing skillful about it or any of the mental factors accompanying it. But immediately afterwards there can be another moment of experiencing, another citta accompanied by awareness and other wholesome mental factors, so that one can see that some mental factors can't arise together.
So to find out
more about
one thing at a time.
To find out more about them, one can find out more about what states of mind, what mental factors are good, are skillful, which will bring skillful results, and which states of mind are unskillful, so that one can know more about when the moment of experiencing is skillful, when it's not skillful, so that one can be quite sure that when there is the dose that you were talking about, that at that moment that state of mind is unskillful, there's nothing good about it, there's no awareness, there's no understanding. At that moment, no concern for anyone else, no matter.
When I first started hearing about citta and chittasika, I thought, goodness, all these things one has to start being aware of, when in fact you can only be aware of
one thing
at
a time.
They arise and fall away without awareness, that there can be awareness of one of them at a time.
I think it's very easy when one starts reading and finding out about chittas and chittasikas, that's very easy to somehow forget that it's something different from the seeing right now. Or the
book being published very shortly in Adelaide by a Dharma group called Be Here Now, which is a translation of the tape Bhikkhu Dharma Dara made in Adelaide, and it's an excellent tape.
More and more I just want to go back to the texts themselves.
Yes.
That's what I was wondering, at what point one went to the English translations of the Pali text? Like, at what point does one start reading the Abhidhamma?
Any time.
I think the suttas are very nice too. When you come into London there is the Pali text Society, and I have quite a lot of books that you can look at sometimes.
Actually, when I was in Sri Lanka, Bhikkhu Dharma Dara was constantly talking about studying with a friend, selecting a passage maybe from a sutta and really examining it. Not just simply reading through it quickly, but you know, maybe even taking one or two lines at a time, if necessary, and examining the meaning. And I started doing this with a friend in Sri Lanka.
That's rather nice.
He gave me an article about the five etiquettes, and it took us about 2 weeks just to go through about 3 pages.
Nina and I, we send each other lists of references now, things that we found that are interesting, or, and that can be nice because it can just encourage you to read.
And also perhaps you may do it with another person, whereas you wouldn't necessarily do it by yourself.
Yes, yeah.
One question I wanted to ask is that since I started reading Buddhist writings about 3 years ago, I was sort of interested in a sort of casting my net rather broadly instead of, I didn't feel like getting down to one thing right away. So I was investigating different traditions from other Tibetan Mahayana traditions and attending teachings from different lamas here, and going to Thailand also gave me this extraordinary opportunity of taking teachings from different people and meeting you. And I find your teachings to be unique, you know, in what I have experienced of the Dhamma as what I've experienced the Dhamma to be taught. And I find much greater similarity, for example, among different other approaches to the Dhamma, especially those that place emphasis on meditation practice. Even those that place emphasis on intellectual understanding, even between Theravada and Mahayana, I still find a lot of similarity, you know, in the style and just slightly different differences in emphasis. I find in your teachings something sort of radical and something very different. And also I find in your approach the idea that, I mean, this is the approach. And I wonder if you could make a comment about, I mean, is the state of Buddhism in such a state of decline and degeneration that in fact there are just a multitude of wrong
When I was something that I had a discussion with Prince Jin about whilst in Ceylon, because the first time I went to Ceylon, it was a Buddhist country, and I was living in a temple for so many months, and I was told by all the people from Ceylon that these were the people that were the foremost authorities in Buddhism, and these were the people that I should go to for my, with my questions, because these were the arahats that were fully enlightened that knew all the answers. And I would go to these authorities and find that I didn't quite get the answers and it didn't quite kick into place, however much respect I might have. And I began to just sort of wonder and question, wasn't at all sure. And then I started listening to Jin's tapes and, you know, a lot of things that I read and studied, really started answering a lot of the questions I couldn't get the answers from elsewhere. Just to suddenly realise how much of what one just assumed because everyone told you was right view was, and to start realising that maybe it isn't at all. You know, I found it really quite a shock. And
actually, being in Sri Lanka for 7 weeks and listening to many different views about things reinforced what I understand of your teachings, rather than destroy my confidence in it, it reinforced understanding I do have.
I must admit I had the same experience too. My first reaction to your teachings were a lot of dosa. And then I went up to Chiang Mai and had a lot more dosa. And then I came down and I said, well, this is dosa. This dosa isn't so bad.
I think in the end, it just has to come back to one's own confidence
and
what is right, and one has to just find out for oneself, and that's why it's so important to question and consider. Not just in here, but to request and consider
and
again and find out for oneself what's right. And I find it now just so helpful to go back to the text and the suttas, and to I find that the more things make sense, the more I read them in a totally different way. Things take on such a different light. So.
Where is Buddhism practiced in its purest form? Is it in Thailand or is it? I know in America, of course, is it? There are a lot, aren't there? But in England too. But even so, I wonder where. I'm just wondering where it is purest or strongest.
I think it depends on those four factors again, isn't the right person, which can be anywhere.
Yes.
Really, wherever the conditions are to meet the right person, yes. Not necessarily even in a Buddhist country.
But also, really, I mean, when one considers, one talks about Buddhism and calls oneself a Buddhist, but really all Buddhism is in the moment too. So if there's right understanding of what reality is right now, then that is understanding and appreciating the teachings of the Buddha. And when there's no understanding and wrong view and greed and anger at that moment, where is the Buddhism, where is the understanding of the Buddha's teaching?
It isn't the sort of thing that really can go in a sort of self-taught manual. That's why one needs the instruction or Kunsijin or guidance to see if we're going along the right path.
I think also, I mean, for me anyway, I mean, the more I realise how little understanding there is of what is happening now, how much ignorance we have accumulated, the more one can appreciate and have compassion even for how hard it is for everyone else as well, because one realises how little we really know about what's going on now, and so for everyone.
And how lost a lot of people are, you see, one has to, when it comes down to it. How lonely and lost.
You think you've heard the right thing and you think you're beginning to understand, it's very easy to have those things when you listen to what you consider to be wrong view. And at that moment, there's no practice. No,
no.
When Bhikkhudhammadhara came back to Australia in 1976, these sort of things were going through my mind. So I started listening again, and of course the whole thing then started making a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, listening to the tapes.
No, listening to the monk when he came back to Australia.
Yeah.
So it's really, I suppose, only been since early 76 that the whole thing started to make a bit more sense.
When it's not the right practice or the Eightfold Path yet, it can be the object of desire, and it always lures people to think that it's this, or it's this, but it's not real. So it seems to be the full understanding of strange thing, or it looks strange, or it looks something, but it cannot eradicate the wrong view or ignorance of reality which appears now as it is.
I could certainly see that there was, understand intellectually that there was no self in control. And I was also beginning to understand a little bit more of what Bhikkhudhammadhara was saying, but I couldn't bridge that gap between that understanding and understanding how one could have direct experience of what Bhikkhudhammadhara was talking about. And it's only, I think, been perhaps in the last 6 months that I've begun to just begin to understand that yes, seeing is real. These things are real. And if we begin to understand how to be aware, then we can be aware of whatever appears. But that took some time.
And one must be very courageous to be able to detach from clinging to strange happening or the result without studying the true nature of reality which appears.
Yes, I know. I'm just beginning to appreciate your point about one must have courage. Because sometimes really the last thing we want is awareness.
And desire or craving is very crafty, that it can lure anyone to other moment instead of studying and developing right understanding of present object.
Because attachment sometimes can be so pleasant.
Yes.
But we think everything's all right. And we don't really care too much about awareness then, developing awareness then.
And sometimes we would like to have lots of awareness in a day. They don't see that it doesn't matter whether awareness arises or not. It depends on right understanding, which should be developed that can eliminate the attachment to the object which appears.
Yes. I was very pleased that Bhikkhudhammadhara and Johnson were in Sri Lanka, because Although listening to many different views reaffirmed my confidence in what I've been taught. You know, as Chip said, just about every book you pick up talks about meditation in terms of developing tranquility first before one can be aware. And I used to go along to the Buddhist Information Centre every evening, and it was very good to listen to the right thing being taught over and over again. And I said to Bhikkhudharma Dharo, what can one do, what can one pick up in fact to read that confirms right view, rather than picking something up that constantly talks about wrong view? And this is in fact when he started talking about maybe picking up a sutta and studying it with a friend who is developing the practice along the same lines as yourself. Which I thought was a very good idea if you are in such a position to be able to do this. I think it is a very good idea. Perhaps one wouldn't necessarily get around to doing it by oneself. But I found that at times also I was in a very awkward situation, staying with Sinhalese people who had been Buddhists all their lives, and of course naturally we'd get around to talking about the Dharma. And it took, I think, and takes with everyone a great deal of tact and skill to be able to not compromise your principles, but at the same time to be able to talk about it in such a way that one has compassion for the other person, and that one tries to, as little as possible, be a conditioned Vedosa. I found that a great learning experience.
Reality is so subtle that one has to study it in order to have full understanding of it. Like tranquility or calmness. One seems to understand it, that it's the moment of pleasant feeling or not being as busy in daily work as usual. But that is not the reality of calmness at all. Mm. So each word which represents each reality should be studied in order to have full understanding of it. Or concentration, one-pointedness. It arises all the time, so it can be the unwholesome one-pointedness, concentration, or wholesome one-pointedness, or wholesome concentration. And this is the sutta. Buddha also taught about the unwholesome concentration and wholesome concentration.
May I ask, I know that this must have been asked before, but I want to ask the awkward questions, because this is our golden opportunity. It seems that all these things that one concentrates on seem to make one more self-aware. And if the goal is to be selfless, you know, concentration, mindfulness, awareness, and everything is inclined to make one more self-concentrated when one should really be less.
That's it. When it's wrong concentration, it cannot lead to the more right understanding or any understanding at all.
Yes. I know that one shouldn't consider the I all the time. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
wrong.
Yes,
one shouldn't consider. So one, with right intention, say, or right effort, or right thinking, one doesn't want to concentrate on me, I, everything. But as you're going along, practicing the Dharma, it all seems to refer back to oneself.
Yes, accepting that if one is developing gusala,
I'm talking about on the way.
Yes, but on the way we're trying to develop as much gusala
as possible.
At a moment of, say, true generosity, there's no... is there attachment? There can't be attachment at a moment of generosity,
no.
Can there? There can't be any attachment at a moment of gusala at all.
No.
And so, you know, whilst on one hand it seems as if we're concentrating on the self, if we're having the right understanding of what we're doing,
Mm.
We're doing more towards developing detachment from the self.
Yes. But in the meanwhile, it'd be lovely to get to that point of detachment from and non-attachment. But in the meanwhile, practicing the Dharma, or trying to get along, is that difficult to choose one's words without saying the wrong thing? It seems that one does concentrate on oneself.
Yeah, I say that at moment of being generous or giving away things, there is no attachment to the concept of self, because it's moment of kusala, but it cannot eradicate the wrong view of self by being generous.
Mm.
But at moment of being generous, it's kusala, so it's not the attachment to the view or the idea of self.
Yes.
But it cannot eradicate wrong view of self. That's why one has to, that's why there's only one way to eradicate wrong view of self by developing
I can understand this with say true generosity, because that it can be selfless. But when it comes to the point of the senses, eye, mind, doors, seeing, hearing, touching, all these things, it is all to do with whatever one might call this, whatever it is that one's got. All these things. It seems that if you're thinking at all, you're thinking about hard or soft, seeing, the experiencing, the mindfulness of the thought or the awareness or the... It all seems to go around here, whereas I would like it to go spreading out. I mean, mustn't say I, but it would be nice if it spread out. Do you understand what I mean?
But if we're developing all forms of kusala,
then we must start.
Aren't we nice for people to be around for a start, and that way we're affecting people probably in a more positive way.
I can see that eventually this will have a very good effect.
If we're kinder,
that the effect will be
generous.
Good on everybody and on the general thing. But to begin with, it strikes other people too that one is very much concerned, not with some of the good things that I know are kusala, like true generosity that you mentioned. I think that's it. Easier, if I may say, to...
But I think that if one finds out more about seeing and learns more to be aware of seeing, then seeing, one can, and the more one sees seeing is just seeing, not my seeing,
yes.
So much, so important, so much more special than anyone else's seeing. The more we think in terms of my seeing, which is so important, the more we're going to cleanse ourselves, whereas the more we begin to develop awareness of different characteristics as they are, common to all, not my seeing, not my
anger,
that's so
seeing,
special. In fact, it leads to less concern of ourselves, because the more one's going to realise that seeing is just seeing, common to all of us, not mine, that's so different, so special, so important.
Yes.
And it's because we're so used to thinking of my seeing, my anger, so important, so special, that we are so involved and with our problems and...
Exactly. Yes, I understand that eventually, but it's just at the beginning.
The thing is that we may try and explain these things to people and they may understand or they may not understand.
Mm.
And we have no control over whether they understand or they don't.
No.
So I suppose it all gets back to whether we have confidence in whether we're doing the right thing or not. I know exactly what you mean. I know that I know my family, for instance, think that I spend a lot of time
thinking about oneself,
preoccupying my time and thoughts with talking about Dharma, which ultimately has to do with oneself. And it seems like a complete dichotomy that on one hand we're talking about eradicating self, but we spend all this time talking about the self.
You see, there are people like, say, Mother Teresa in Calcutta, who doesn't sit there worrying about whether she's aware or not. She gets out and looks after dying people, and people look after spastics.
I think one can go out and look after dying people and at the same time, because developing awareness doesn't mean that one has to change one's way of life. It doesn't mean that one has to stop being busy or suddenly sit and just think for 3 hours. My mother would say to me, I haven't got time or something. But in fact, awareness can, there are no limits to what awareness can be aware of. It doesn't mean that one has to stop looking after dying people. On the contrary, the more understanding that is developed of what's going on, the better one's going to do whatever one's doing.
Yes, I can see that seems to be a point that one hopes to reach, but when people start, I don't know if you found it or not, but then you probably haven't, that a lot of time is taken up, apart from the chores of the day, the quick chores, and they're not, in thinking about this thing, in studying it, in discussing it, it is time consuming. And, and so I think, I mean, eventually I'm sure one could practice
Dharma
and do a mantle 10 job or mantle 6.
What do I find is
Yes, and that would be ideal, but I think getting to that.
I mean, what I find is I live in London, I lead an incredibly busy life because I've got a very busy full-time
job,
you know, teaching in a psychiatric day centre.
Do you?
You know, it takes me 2 hours travelling there and back, so I get back absolutely exhausted. But I find I go for so long, and I find that after a while I really need some, it's really good to have some discussion or feedback with other people interested in the Dharma. Because one can very easily find that one is going very much against the stream of things and giving out all the time.
It reinforces.
Sometimes it's good to just have that feedback, which is why the main reason I came down here, because I think sometimes it is good to just meet the right
sure
person
and
hear the right thing.
It helps you enormously, I'm sure it does. I mean, I can feel it.
Yes, I find that having a busy life, what everyone's doing,
it is going to
help. It is going to make all the difference. And sometimes it is good just to have that discussion or that feedback or that, just to really give one confidence in what one feels is right. And support that one's not the only one with these strange ideas.
Yes, because there aren't so many around
which is why, you know, I put so much emphasis on going to salon for seminars or whatever, just because
next time you'll go to Bangkok, will you?
Maybe.
No, not at all. Not at all. Fine rhythm. It's not as cold as I think.
No. As cold as I'd warned you. This is the first time you've been to the West.
Yes. And I like England very much.
You feel at home here. I find that England, London anyway, it's a very central point. Everyone passes through sooner or later. A lot of opportunities for meeting people that are interested in the Dharma. It's a very central thing.
It's a pity that this trip is not the Dharma discussion.
Next time. But I think just in the fact that you're coming and giving your parents such a good holiday, that's...
Because you see that only one day or one discussion is not enough.
No. And there's so many, I feel, in London, so many friends of mine so interested in the Dharma, and I explain things, and sometimes it's so nice to have someone else to come and explain things better. And so many people who would really like to meet you, that it's...
But you explain very well to us. You are very helpful, and you can help a lot of people. And they know that.
Sometimes it's really good, however, because in my work I teach in a psychiatric center where people have come out of mental hospitals, and we have a lot of discussions. And with my friends also, but sometimes it's just really good to have someone else to come along and to put things in a different way, which is nice to have Bronstein and other dumb friends come.
We can see that the practice is not common to all. Mm. It's only for those who are ready to understand it and develop it. Because the craving is so great.
We have to have patience, not just with ourselves, but with other people also. Mm.
And when one has right understanding of teachings, one can continue on reading any part of the Pitaka. Mm.
Now I'm once a week I go to learn Pali in North London, and we started with 20 people in the class. Now there's only me and one other person. And
it's very difficult.
And it's very nice now because I've been doing it all year. Now we read a bit of a text and we translate it and we discuss it, and I really enjoy it, but it's so hard because it's on a Friday night, and on Friday I'm so exhausted from work because I've been working so hard, And I go there and I'm so tired, but I really want to do it because I find it so interesting.
You have accumulation for it.
I really like the language. And I find that it puts the sutta in such a different light, to find out for oneself about the Pali and to consider the real meaning of the words, not just the English translation, that it's a very good opportunity for considering more.
And sutta is very beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And it bears the meaning of Dhamma, reality, mm-hmm. all the time, mm-hmm. depending on the reader's understanding.
Which is why it's so nice to reread again and again when one understands a little bit better. I'm so active, I get so involved with the work and the people I'm with that I find it very hard to find time for studying and the writing that I like to do.
In one sutta it says about day time and night time. Day time is time for developing calmness, but it doesn't mean that one has intention to develop calmness by way of jhana, but it means that one always meets people, different ones, all the time. So one knows whether one is calm or not, to cope with different people and different situations. And at night it's time for seclusion. And seclusion here doesn't mean that one has to go somewhere else, because one is so very secluded when there is right understanding of reality which appears, because there is no one in the object which appears. Mm-hmm. So it's very secluded. Mm-hmm. It's another world, the mm-hmm. inner world.
But shouldn't there be that seclusion in the daytime also when one is
yes,
calm?
Yes, but calmness is apparent, because when there is no one at night, you are alone. Why does Buddha talk about seclusion then? So it means that it's time to have the right understanding,
mm-hmm.
which appears very clear enough to
mm-hmm.
to see it as it is. But it doesn't mean that at daytime it cannot be like
mm-hmm.
that. But it emphasizes that it's time for working
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and meeting different people and different situations. And when Buddha talk about calmness, it doesn't mean only calmness by way of jhana, but it includes calmness when there's right understanding as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the object changes all the time.
Mm.
And seclusion doesn't mean that one has to go to other places when one stays alone in
mm-hmm.
one's room
mm-hmm.
already at night.
Yes.
But seclusion there, it means the seclusion when there is no self, no body, no existence in the object which appears.
But surely that kind of seclusion should be developed all the time, whether
he,
one is free or without.
He uses different words, but he doesn't mean that it should be separated.
Mm-hmm.
That it's
just
his wisdom
mm-hmm.
to let people see what happens at daytime and at nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
But it includes the development of Satipatthana
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Do you know which sutta this is?
Yes, in Thai, and I could remember it now. When you read the sutta, you can find it by yourself.
Do you know where the sutta is?
I couldn't remember
no.
the name and the section now. But I think that I should bring this subject to help people understand what is meant by samatha
mm-hmm.
and the word seclusion
mm-hmm.
at night. Because people just interpret
mm-hmm.
word by word.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really understand that calmness also includes in the development of Satipatthana as well.
I find it so helpful when we were talking last year about learning to live alone. I find
mm-hmm.
it such a useful reminder. About 2 weeks ago I was at a party and there were so many people and I had a lot of aversion. And I found it so helpful just to be reminded of having to learn to live alone with the reality, whether one's in the midst
mm-hmm.
of a big party of people, or whether one's on one's own, or wherever,
mm-hmm.
just learning to live alone with the realities as it is, very, very
but
useful.
But then one can, although you don't just drop out of things because one starts hearing about the Dharma, it seems to me that it can be quite a natural progression, that as you go on, you do seek. Perhaps you don't seek parties quite so much, or you don't seek some of the situations that you sought before, but it happens gradually.
Mm.
by nature, by its nature, not by one's will.
Not by forcing it or thinking one
should. And one knows whatever one does.
It's by condition.
It's by condition. So one does not worry about anything at all, because one has right understanding about reality, which is conditioned. This is the way.
Other people who are interested in Buddhism, I think it's so strange that I should live in a busy city and should be so busy and with so many people all the time. But different people, different accumulations, different conditions at different times.
And it agrees.